Welcome to KABU, Maureen Katz.
Hi, it's so nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, you spent weeks with water protectors at the Indigenous-led frontline camps fighting the construction of Enbridge's Line 3 in Minnesota. And as Enbridge prepared to start pumping tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada through Line 3 in Minnesota earlier this month, Winona LaDuke released a statement. So before we talk about your experiences there and how we might think about this defeat in stopping Line 3, I want to read a statement from LaDuke that was released the weekend before Indigenous Peoples Day. So here's the quote. "It's somehow fitting irony as Indigenous Day approaches on October 11th, once known by another name, that a new Columbus is about to pump oil through Line 3, the last tar sands pipeline. That is the colonial-like corporation Enbridge." Well, LaDuke, founder of Honor the Earth and a leader in the fight to stop Line 3, also listed in this statement the many victories of this five-year struggle against the pipeline, as well as outlining some of what she sees as the future path of resistance. But let's start with that statement about the new Columbus. What does that statement mean to you, Maureen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful statement, and she has made many beautiful statements around, well, all along, but around the completion of the pipeline and the pumping of oil by Enbridge. But I don't know how new it is, the idea of large capitalist companies that don't care for the people at all, or the land, or the law in this case, and are sacrificing the future of everyone by pumping out tar sands and then putting oil through pristine areas and a fifth of the world's fresh waterways with multiple spills for the sake of profit. So that's one Columbus in discovering other people's property and lands and the rights of nature and just taking them over. I think the other Columbus that we should think about is that the state violence and the collusion of, in this case, the Minnesota State Police and Task Force, the Department of Homeland Security, and even this week with the climate strike led by Indigenous people in Washington, D.C., where the occupation of the Department of Interior by Indigenous people, peaceful, civil disobedience, nonviolent, no property destruction, was met with very harsh physical arrests by the police in D.C. by canine units in a way that was so in contrast to how, for instance, the protesters who were violent and destroying property on January 6th were met.
Before we go into what the resistance faced in those Indigenous-led frontline camps in Minnesota along Line 3 construction sites, can you say a little bit about what led you to join the resistance there as a non-Indigenous person?
I went because there was a call that was put out in December of 2020 that said, we've exhausted all of the legal processes that we can, and we need people, the Indigenous communities, the Anishinaabe and the resistance within Minnesota said, we need people to come and become water protectors and come and support fighting this pipeline being built. So I wanted to answer that call and felt that that was just an essential way of doing the prevention of climate destruction, not just the mitigation of it after the fact, and also to support the treaty rights that were being violated flagrantly by Enbridge.
And that's one meaning of being an ally or a co-conspirator. There's different terms for joining a resistance that is in all of our interest, as well as fulfilling a moral obligation to address the history of violence and displacement of Native peoples.
Yes, absolutely. It's beautifully said. I think the question is, or the issue is, that it's not simply that we are redressing and trying to do our part to heal and not allow further damage to Indigenous peoples and violation of their lands and our treaties with them as white people or non-Indigenous. But I also think that there's a way that we are equally invested in the world that's going forward for our kids and our grandkids and our communities. So it's we all have a stake in this. In this case, it is this struggle has been Indigenous-led, as have been many of the major environmental campaigns to try to stop destruction of the earth, right? So,
and this was also identified as women and Two-Spirit-led sites of resistance, and yes, in that sense was somewhat different from Standing Rock, and because the women in recent years and what's identified as Two-Spirit Native people have been at the forefront of the resistance and organizing and in leadership roles.
Absolutely. So what's quite remarkable is the way that this whole resistance was organized and went forward. Standing Rock, you had 11,000 people on the plains fighting, right, in Dakotas, fighting the crossing into, you know, into the rivers or under the rivers for the Dakota pipeline. In this case, Enbridge decided they were going to avoid that and wanted to build all hundreds of miles all at the same time. It's also heavily forested. And there were 22 river crossings that they had to dig underneath. So there were a series of Indigenous-led camps that were bought and by Indigenous peoples and, as you said, Indigenous women and collectives that were two-spirited that set up a number of camps for people to come to that were resistance camps to do strategy and try to block what was happening with nonviolent civil disobedience. There was a task force that was called the Northern Minnesota Task Force. Then there was a center set up called the Fusion Center that was set up with the Northern Minnesota Task Force, paid for by Enbridge, along with the Homeland Security. And the Fusion Center surveilled all of these camps, and they won reasons of the Patriot Act, said that that in arrest cases that the arrestees could not depose the records of the Fusion Center, so it was stayed secret how they were surveilling the different communities. And when I was at one of the camps, for instance, in February, there was constantly five cars outside of the Indigenous camp that was there, the protest camp, surveilling and harassing anyone who came in and out of the camp. So I was driving a rental car from the Minnesota airport, and they followed me every time I drove in from Park Rapids to the camp, and once tried to run me off the road and pulled over numerous people. That was the early stages. Then they started blockading the camps, not letting people go into the camps that were legally owned by them and their own private property. And that escalated to the physical confrontations with protesters, where they were brutally arrested for misdemeanors, and that escalated to the agreement that they could use non-lethal force, which was rubber bullets and tear gas, as well as what they call pain compliance, which is taking people who have locked in to a structure so that they can block a road so construction cannot take place, and basically torturing. I'm a psychoanalyst, and I've worked with torture victims, and using methods that are CIA instructed methods of torture to make people have so much pain that they will unlock themselves. So they did these pain compliance techniques. And all of this was happening nonstop for 10 months of the campaign to try to stop the construction of the pipeline.
So Maureen, before we stop today, I do want to talk with you as a psychoanalyst and an activist about how we recognize and mourn such losses that on one level, by one measure, this was a defeat, the fight lost. The Enbridge is pumping oil through that lethal pipeline, but there are many lessons that to be learned from this. Before closing, how could you say something both about the importance of mourning and grieving at these times, as well as looking ahead and rechanneling what we've learned and what Indigenous people have learned on the front lines of these struggles for a very long time, that leads them not to be surprised by how the state's enlisted in this way, but how we work with these two dynamics of resistance, both grief and loss, and the inspiration we gain and the insights in going ahead.
Yeah, definitely. And we need a whole nother show to talk about that. I think that there's been a movement and a consolidation of people working together under Indigenous leadership and also in their own communities about ways about how you stand up to this kind of bullying and illegal activity at the part of the state and corporations. And it's a phenomenal movement that involves older people. I was there with 1,000 grandmothers, younger people, youth who are involved, a very diverse, two-spirited group of people that
is very intersectional in many dimensions and alliances across generations and across groups that may be anchored in different identities, but have this common sense of a threat to survival of the planet.
Absolutely.
On the planet itself.
That's right. And that is not a defeat. That is the strength of the movement. And what I had said to friends was, we lose until we win, because we have to win. And so, yes, this is a loss. It's not done yet. We will keep fighting this. But that is, in fact, what is necessary to happen. I want to say a quick thing about mourning. It's essential that people stop and take a moment and are able to mourn what it means to have had the land destroyed and this pipeline be built and this criminal activity take place. And mourning in this case does not mean having a grievance. It means being able to grieve, to be sad, to be able to internalize the movement and the sense of the power of what were the best of the things that were lost by this pipeline being built, and to be able to go forward then in a thoughtful way with strategy and tactics and gratitude towards the people that came together and led this and came to fight it, and then be able to go forward from that with that internalization of that, those positive ways that we've learned to work together in order to move forward. But if you don't grieve, then you don't actually acknowledge what's happened. And you can't move forward in a way that allows for healthy relationships and a sense of power, which is essential for the movement to be able to be successful.
And to be guided by the spirits that have gone before, even as whether secular or people from different spiritual traditions, that principle of being guided by those who've gone before and recognizing the losses, but also the wisdom and knowledge that comes out of knowing our histories.
Absolutely. And it means tolerating sadness, right? And not just having that turn into anger or self-destructive or community-destructive behaviors, because that's allowing the oppressor to take occupation inside of us.
As groups fight against each other, as the enemy recedes from reach, there can be this dynamic of turning on one another.
That's right. Who didn't do enough? Who didn't do the right thing?
Maureen Katz, thank you so much for being with us today and talking about the Stop Line 3 fight. And I hope to have you back on the show and to talk further about these dynamics you only briefly were able to touch upon at the end. Thank you for your work as a water protector, an earth protector, and we'll talk again.
Great. Thank you, Jan.